You'd be crazy not to want what dietary supplements promise. Strong bones, more energy, supercharged immunity to disease, and healthy organs. And half of us take some kind of dietary supplement every day. Whether their largely unregulated products actually deliver on the claims they make remains a hotly debated question, but it's one that users are often willing, a bet that users are often willing to make. What many of us don't know is that a surprising number of supplements on the market do not actually contain the substances listed on the label. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Jillian Findley has been investigating this for Frontline, and she learned that the FDA has a very small team assigned to keep tabs on this $30 billion industry, and the vast majority of tens of thousands of different supplements on the market are not inspected or safety tested by the people profiting from their sale. The documentary Supplements and Safety airs Tuesday night, January 19th at 9 o'clock on KERA-TV. Jillian, welcome to Think.
Hi. Nice to be with you.
The surprises started for me right off the top with this program. Dietary supplements are a $30 billion industry.
Yeah. Pretty big, huh?
Yeah. What falls under that umbrella?
Well, that's everything from herbal supplements to workout supplements to your everyday vitamins, you know, the multivitamin that you may take or give your children every day. It's all one big umbrella.
And there are 85,000 different products that qualify.
That's the estimate, yeah. Yes.
Hard to believe. Right. Getting into the business is just about as simple as finding somebody willing to buy whatever it is you call a supplement.
So it seems. I mean, that was, for me, that was my first big shock because one of the first shoots we did in the making of this documentary is we went to Long Island, New York, and we met a woman who literally had got into the business at her kitchen table. She at the time was married to a chiropractor. He had an interest, in supplements and how to improve people's health through diet. She had some undergraduate degrees from university in, you know, chemistry. But that was about it. And together, they put together formulations and started literally making tablets and capsules at the kitchen table and marketed them.
Ironically, this company was called Purity First. People might assume that, you know, the other shoe's about to drop with this story.
Mm-hmm. There is another shoe. It was called Purity First. And she believed that that's what made their product different, is that they were ensuring a certain level of quality because they were making them themselves. At some point, they get, by virtue of success, it gets to be more than they can make at the kitchen table. And so they contract out some of the manufacturing. And it was when they do that that they run into trouble. Some of their there was a B50 vitamin tablet that they made that was quite popular. But some of their clients started reporting side effects. They couldn't quite figure out what accounted for this. Their first instinct, she said, was, well, these sort of coincided around the time of Hurricane Sandy. And maybe it was because these people had been in their basements cleaning out water, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Somehow they were contaminated. But eventually they send these people off to an environmental specialist who actually does some work, tests the vitamins. That is the one thing they all have in common. And lo and behold, discovers that mixed in with the vitamin B, there are two anabolic steroids,
wow,
which they come to the conclusion probably explained the kinds of side effects these people were experiencing. And I should say, some fairly serious ones. You know, these are people, even to this day, who claim that their lives and their health have been compromised by as what we now accept to be contaminated vitamins.
And I suppose the courts will rule on all of this, but the Purity First folks say they didn't know the pills were tainted because, like a lot of other companies, as you mentioned, they were sourcing the contents of their products from another company.
That's right. And so they trusted that other company. They say they actually received documentation. This was a company called Mira. They obtained documentation that assured them that, you know, they were following good manufacturing practices and that there were, you know, the sufficient tests in place to test raw ingredients and all that kind of stuff. So they, you know, they just assumed. It turns out, as further investigation reveals, that in fact this manufacturer, Mira, had twice before this had already been cited by FDA inspectors for bad manufacturing practices. And when this all comes to the forefront and questions are being asked, the owners of Purity First get on the phone to the owner of Mira and say, "Come on, what happened? What went wrong here?" At which point they say, he revealed to them that he was also in the business of making male enhancement pills. And his only plausible explanation, he said, was that perhaps one of the mixers hadn't been thoroughly cleaned and there was a contamination that went on with the steroids that he was using for the male enhancement pills. That seems to be the general explanation. I should say we tried repeatedly to speak to Mira. We tried try to get some independent verification for a lot of this, but the company has since gone out of business, forced out of business, actually, by the FDA in this case.
Jillian, many folks who buy vitamins and herbal supplements and different things buy them in the same places they get over-the-counter drugs, which are carefully regulated by the FDA. Supplements come in similar packaging. They're often shelved right by the pain relievers and decongestants, but they are regulated in an entirely different way.
Absolutely. And this, to me, was the second big surprise of this investigation. I did not, first of all, I should say, I don't live in the United States. I'm Canadian, and this was a joint production with the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. But I was floored to learn that in the United States, there is absolutely no obligation on a manufacturer for pre-market approval. Nobody has to come in nor do they have to provide any evidence to the regulators in the United States to say not only that this product, whatever it is going to do what we say it's going to do, in other words, to prove that it's effective, but they don't even have to prove that it's safe. So, you know, when you get right down to it, you have no way as a consumer of knowing what is in the bottle that you are purchasing.
How did they come to be classified so differently from the things that are regulated like drugs?
It's not going to surprise many people to hear the simplistic explanation is politics. This goes back to the early 90s. Just so we're clear, you're absolutely right that pharmaceutical drugs are regulated separately. Manufacturers do have to provide evidence to show efficacy and safety, and that evidence can sometimes be, you know, quite onerous. They have to show results of large-scale independent testing, placebo-controlled, double-blind studies. You know, the kinds of scientific work that takes, frankly, a lot of money. The reason that supplements don't goes back to the passing of legislation in the early 1990s. It was a law called DSHEA. And what that did was it exempted, in essence, supplement manufacturers from that kind of rigorous evidentiary-based procedure. And there were efforts at the time to make it much more strict. We interview in the documentary, a former head of the FDA who had come to office in the 90s, determined to actually make it more difficult to get supplements on the market, to put in some kind of testing, and specifically to disallow the kind of advertising that was going on at the time, you know, that basically where manufacturers could make pretty much any claim they wanted and not have to provide any backing to say that the claim was true. It turned into a real battle with what at that point was an industry that was growing and becoming more and more powerful, had very powerful lobbyists, had very powerful friends in Congress. Senator Orrin Hatch from Utah was sort of the point man for the industry. The industry was very big in Utah. And essentially, as David Kessler says in the documentary, they went to war against us. And it's a war that they ultimately won. They were able to maneuver politically in order to essentially create the system that there is today, and that is that there is no requirement for these manufacturers to prove anything. The one caveat to that, I should say, in complete fairness and transparency, is the FDA did some years later implement policies that would require manufacturers to demonstrate good manufacturing practices. That is what they call it. The issue is there's now upwards of 4,000 manufacturers in the United States, as you've just talked about, 85,000 different products on the market. The division, the department in the FDA that actually deals with dietary supplements has a staff of 25 people. Hmm. So do the math, you know, really, what is the level of scrutiny that is going on of this industry? I think it's pretty small.
My guest is Frontline correspondent Jillian Findley. Her documentary, Supplements and Safety, airs Tuesday night, January 19th at 9 o'clock on KERA Channel 13 Television. If you would like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Frontline correspondent Jillian Findley, who contributed to the new documentary Supplements and Safety. It airs on Frontline tomorrow night, January 19th at 9 o'clock on KERA TV. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Jillian, I want to go back to something you said, which is that the FDA is authorized to check these supplement manufacturers for good manufacturing processes. To be clear, this is like making sure that the lab is clean and that they're not reusing crushed capsules, that sort of thing. This is not about testing the contents of the supplements themselves.
That's right, Chris. Exactly. It doesn't have anything to do with the quality of what's in that tablet or the capsule or that you're actually buying at your pharmacy or your health food store.
What kinds of claims are supplement manufacturers allowed to make on the labels?
Well, it's interesting because this was one of the saw-offs. Before we broke, we were talking about this legislation that was passed in the 90s. And one of the saw-offs was that, okay, the manufacturers couldn't make just any claim. They couldn't, for instance, come on and say, take vitamin whatever and it will cure your cancer. But they could make different kinds of claims that were suggestive. They could come on, for instance, and say, calcium promotes good bone density growth. They could come on and say fish oil is helpful towards blood circulation or something like that. You know, they could make things that I think to the average busy, overwhelmed consumer, in essence, say, you know, take this and you will either not have cancer or heart disease. But in fact, don't really say that. And you know, and this is the kind of things that just get vamped up in their marketing materials and the advertising that they do. So they skirt around a lot of things, I think, is what the accusation is.
Yeah, and in fact, I was poking around online after you know, we decided to do this show, and I found that maybe the companies themselves can claim plausible deniability, but there are lots of other people maybe surrounding these products that will say that will make those direct claims, right? That are not technically don't appear to be directly related to the company, but will say, take this product and you will never get cancer.
Absolutely. There's all kinds of them. And, you know, some of them are very famous. We know them, the Dr. Oz's and the like. And then there's all kind, you know, the internet is filled with all kinds of people who will tell you that they know what's best for your health. And you know, where I think this gets dangerous, and, you know, the FDA can't be responsible for all of this, but where it gets dangerous is that there is no monitoring of that. And so not only will they make outrageous claims, they will sometimes tell people that they should be taking doses far in excess of what certainly the mainstream health organizations, the government health organizations in the United States and elsewhere will tell you that you should be taking. You know, there are recommended daily intake levels of virtually every vitamin and supplement out there that the Institutes of Health and others have you know, you can go onto the websites and you can find these. And yet it's not hard to find examples of people, you know, advocating for you to take many times those recommended daily intake levels. And nobody knows what the repercussions of that are going to be. And in fact, in some cases, scientific studies have been done, and I'm thinking now around some of the antioxidants. We talk about this in the documentary tomorrow night as well. Increasingly scientific evidence is saying that when you take some of these supplements in large doses, you actually increase your chance of things like cancer and cardiovascular disease, all the kinds of problems that we are hoping to mitigate by taking these things every day.
So it's not necessarily true that if a little's good for you, a lot will be better.
Absolutely not. That is the lesson that is being learned. But it's not one that I think is getting through to consumers. Now, that's probably a whole other conversation about why that is, you know, why scientific literature seems to get glossed over in the media and popular literature. And, you know, and yet every cockamamie claim that somebody wants to make seems to get airtime. I mean, it is a reality that surveys have certainly shown this of consumers, that they're not aware of what the latest scientific evidence is. And the latest scientific evidence is often quite contrary to what we are being told and what we have come to believe about some of these supplements.
You have an expert in the piece that says, effectively, the rule of thumb is if you would have to eat an impossible amount of a particular food in order to get the concentration of nutrients that we get in some of these megavitamins, our bodies probably don't want that concentration of megavitamins.
No, this is Dr. Paul Offit, and he is the best-selling author. Some of your listeners may have heard of him. His book on vitamins was called Do You Believe in Magic? So I think that gives you some sense as to what end of the debate he falls on here. But he's also a world-renowned pediatrician at the Children's Hospital in Philadelphia. And it was very interesting to us. We went to visit them there because a couple of years ago, they took a really important stance. They said, you know, we talked to the head pharmacologist there, and she said, you know, we would have people bringing their kids into this hospital literally with shopping bags full of all these different supplements and alternative health products that their children were taking. And she said, you know, we have a policy here that requires us, before we dispense anything, we put any pill into a child's mouth, we need to know what it is and, you know, what the dosage is and ultimately be able to satisfy ourselves that we're not doing something that's potentially harmful. And so they took the position that before they were going to dispense any dietary supplement, they wanted assurances and evidence from manufacturers that supplement was in fact what the labeling suggested it was on the bottle, and that the dosage was in fact accurate. And so they essentially wrote to manufacturers, told them this. 90% of those they wrote to didn't bother to write back. 10% who did actually provided them information that suggested that in fact they were right to think that there was a problem here, because indeed, you know, they could not verify that their product was what it was, and certainly the dosage levels and and as Sarah Uresh goes on to say in the documentary, this, you know, for a children's hospital, this could be catastrophic, because you think you're providing some kind of a product in very minute amounts, say for a premature baby, and you discover that in fact the formulation is wrong. And, you know, just imagine the kind of damage that could be done by something like that. So it was an indication to her and to the people at the hospital and to Dr. Paul Offit, who you've referenced, that, you know, there is a big problem here with adulteration. Now, that's quite separate from the issue you started to talk about, and that is, are we taking too many? Dr. Offit is quite clear, especially around that group of vitamins that I think we all know the term, the antioxidants, because, you know, certainly in the last number of years, that has been such a big buzzword. You know, they're the ones that kill the free radicals, that make sure that we're not going to get cancer, et cetera, et cetera. Well, this is where a lot of the work has been done on dosage levels. And, you know, the example that he uses in the piece You talk about vitamin C, which is one of the antioxidants. Now, the recommended daily intake for vitamin C is 60 milligrams a day for an adult. He's illustrating the point with very common formulations now have tablets that are 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C. And people routinely take those. To get 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C from a food source, he uses the example of cantaloupes. You'd have to eat between 7 and 8 entire cantaloupes. Now, I mean, imagine just sitting down trying to, stuff 7 or 8 entire cantaloupes into your system. Your stomach wouldn't tolerate it. And he says that's telling you something. If you're dealing with a vitamin that you have to eat that much to get to the point where your body can't tolerate it, you're probably taking too much. And he says there's no way that anybody needs 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C.
And that's before you get to your barrel of spinach for the day, right?
Yes, exactly. And vitamin E, he points out, I think it was something like 1,670 almonds.
Wow.
Is the equivalent of a 1,000 international unit vitamin C or vitamin E tablet. Again, people take those quite routinely, but he would argue you shouldn't.
Let's go to the phones now. We have Lewis on the line in Rowlett. Hi, Lewis.
Yes.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Hey, I was just listening to her, but, you know, how much vitamin do you take? C especially is harmless because I take 8,000 every day. I'm 86, and everyone looks at me and thinks I'm 60 or 55. Now, it's very, very important. My wife took 12,000 a day. That was one of the four vitamins I was saying that she took that caused National Institute of Health to do a 5-year study. They did that, and 5 years later, it was published in Dallas paper, and they lowered the town, the total town got these vitamins. In 5 years, the cancer rate went from 68% down to 20%.
Lewis, thank you so much for your call. Jillian, I think Lewis definitely demonstrates the fact that a lot of people take these things because they care about their health and they really believe they are doing a great thing for their bodies.
There's no question people believe, and I don't want to, I'm not here to stamp on anybody's belief. The position that we set out to do is to say, okay, there's belief and then there's science. What does the science actually tell us? And is it the same? Does it allow people to come to the conclusions they have come to as a result of their beliefs? He talks about vitamin C. I'm going to leave that one aside for a moment, but I do want to talk about vitamin E and vitamin D. There is scientific evidence that is not contested anymore that says if you take too much vitamin E and you're a man, you clearly and definitively increase your risk of prostate cancer. That is not debated in the scientific world. Jump ahead to vitamin D, for instance. There's all kinds of, it's the sunshine vitamin, it's the one, my family doctor a few years ago said, you really ought to be taking lots of vitamin D. Too much can't do you any harm. It's going to do all these wonderful things for you. Well, it turns out that there is real evidence that too much can do you harm. And there's a big study going on now. People are talking about it as the definitive study. At Harvard, a doctor by the name of Dr. Joanne Manson is conducting it. It's the biggest study of its kind in the world, she says. And they don't have the final results. They won't be out for another year or so. But already she is saying people are taking way too much vitamin D. The Institute of Health says that the and I'm just checking my notes here because I want to make sure I get this right, that average adults, adults with, unless you have a demonstrated deficiency in vitamin D, you shouldn't be taking more than 600 international units. Very most 4,000. They say beyond 4,000, you absolutely increase your risk of having some sort of adverse reaction to it. Well, I can just tell you it will take you 2 seconds on the internet to find all kinds of people who will recommend to you that you take 5,000 or even 10,000 international units of vitamin D. She says, we know scientifically that this is going to increase the amount of calcium in your system, in your urine, and that can be associated with kidney stones, with high blood calcium, calcium in the arteries, vascular calcification, as well as soft tissue calcification. And she says that in the scientific world, it is now accepted that there is this U-shaped, what she refers to as a U-shaped reaction to vitamin D in your blood. Those who have too little vitamin D, they know that that can be problematic and can be linked to certain kinds of disease, but also those who have too much. And this is her big concern, is that, you know, we are just assuming, as many people do, that there's no such thing as too much, that, you know, as somebody says to me, at the very most, you know, we're going to have very expensive pee. She says that's not true, that you can be running a risk. And more science is looking at this, and more they are determining that, yes, we can take too much. Not to mention the fact that, you know, we are spending an awful lot of money on things that we don't need.
Jillian Findlay is with me. She's a correspondent for Frontline, and the documentary Supplements and Safety, the Frontline special, airs Tuesday night, January 19th at 9 on KERA-TV. We'll talk more with Jillian in a few minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Frontline correspondent Jillian Findlay. You can watch Supplements and Safety tomorrow night, Tuesday, January 19th, at 9 o'clock on KERA-TV. Before we move on from the nutrition in food to, the comparison between the nutrition in food and in supplements, I want to talk about this. Is there evidence, Jillian, international units of things aside, that something like fish oil in a little tablet or a capsule has the same benefits as, you know, eating a plate of oily fish several times a week?
You'd like to think that was the case, and you know, it's instinct to think, well, if eating fish is good for me and it's the oil in the fish that makes it good for me, then surely if I take the oil in a capsule, that's going to be just as good, and if I take more of it, that will be even better. And maybe that's true. The problem is, from the perspective of scientists, is they can't prove that that's true, and that every time they start looking at this, I want to qualify that, not every time, but increasingly they would argue, when they look at it, they find problems. And so that's, you know, with fish oil, it's a very interesting thing because, again, I think it's the third most widely sold supplement in the United States. It's a big seller. And people buy it in large part because they are told it has protective properties, that it is particularly for your heart. It's going to be good for cardiovascular health. There are two issues with fish oil. One is what you're buying may be problematic simply because of the manufacturing process. Fish oil is an oil, obviously. Oils become rancid very quickly and very easily when they're exposed to oxygen. And so surveys that have been done of commercially available fish oils have shown, a real problem. Even the industry acknowledges that this is a real problem. Levels of oxidation of the fish oil themselves. And the problem with that is oxidized oil contains oxidized lipids, and when it comes to cardiovascular health, they know that oxidized lipids can have an inflammatory effect on the body. Nobody can tell at this point exactly what that mechanism is, but they know it's potentially problematic. And so that is one of the issues with fish oil, is the oxidation problem. The other one is, again, you know, what is the evidence that shows that the oil does have the protective property that we are told repeatedly is there and is the reason that so many people buy and take this stuff? Scientific surveys, we talked to a top epidemiologist from New Zealand who had done sort of the big mega meta-analysis study. In other words, he's taken all the most recent studies on fish oil, all the ones that were published in the most prestigious scientific journals around the world, and he analyze the analysis of all of those different studies. And basically, he says there is no evidence to support that claim, that we cannot say categorically that there is any protective value for fish oil when it comes to things like, you know, protecting you against the incidence of heart attack. So it's, you know, once again, a big seller, one that a lot of people assume that they know something about and are convinced that it's good for them. It's not clear that the science is there.
All right. You have laid out a really good case, Jillian, for, I think, proceeding with caution in using any kind of supplements, vitamins or herbs or whatever. But you and I both know there are people who really believe they derive benefits from these. We'll keep taking them. Those individuals might be surprised to know how often it happens that the thing they've just paid, you know, $24 for a bottle of or whatever the price might be, may be getting exactly 0% of what it says on the bottle.
Yeah, and this is that's a really good point. And I think because, as you point out and as your caller pointed out earlier, so much of this really does count down to people's belief that they do believe this works, and they're completely entitled to their beliefs. But what they're also entitled to is some consumer protection that tells them that if they're going to put down that money and buy, whether it's fish oil capsules or ginkgo or, you know, whatever the, because this is a particular problem with the herbal supplements, especially, that they're getting what they're paying for. And, you know, one of the reasons we launched into this project originally was back in the spring, the Attorney General of New York published a study and then took action against a number of the big retail chains in New York State, because they had actually done a survey and looked at, using DNA testing, taken a bunch of herbal supplements and discovered that only 20% of them actually contained the ingredients that were on their labels. I mean, think about that a minute. It's astounding.
And to be clear, you're talking about big, these are places that most of us would trust. This is like the Targets and Walmarts and CVS's and GNC's of the world. This
Absolutely.
Is not fly-by-night internet companies.
That's right. Exactly. Walmart, Walgreens, Target, and GNC in particular were the four that he targeted. And as he says, you know, they found DNA for asparagus plants. They found DNA for house plants, rice, other things. But not only 20% of what they tested actually had the ingredient that was listed on the labels. And he used the word. It seemed to us that there was a massive fraud going on. So what he did was that he basically ordered all the products off the shelves that they had tested, and he basically started twisting the arms of the retailers, who then in turn had to twist the arms of their suppliers, you know, to start verifying and to be able to prove what was actually in the bottle. One company in particular accepted this right away. GNC, it's the largest supplier. They sort of, I don't want to say rolled over, but they very quickly saw the writing on the wall, I think, and they started actually implementing DNA testing in their manufacturing chain. So they would be able, you know, so that they would have the confidence of knowing that wherever their raw materials and their ingredients are coming from, when they get to the manufacturing plant, they're tested, they know what they are, and they know that when the final product goes out, it's tested as well, so they can pass that assurance on to the consumers. A lot of the others, including the industry spokesman, were, you know, their initial reaction was to call into question the methodology of the testing, you know, to try to argue the point. And it was only very reluctantly that they have come around to this notion that, well, perhaps there really is a problem in this industry with adulteration. Because, as you know, the Attorney General study was probably, if not the most recent, one of the most recent. But you go back a decade, and you know there have been a lot of studies. Some of them small, some of them didn't get a lot of attention at the time, but a lot of them that have come to the same conclusion that there is a big issue with adulteration.
So what can people do if they want to take something like a multivitamin, something that maybe is not a huge quantity, or they have, you know, even a doctor sometimes will recommend people check out these herbal supplements. How can we know we are getting what the label promises?
I think the short answer is you can't, and that's the dismaying part. You know, that's the part that turns this, I think, into a political issue. I mean, among the things that the Attorney General did was to call on Congress and the FDA to change the regulation around dietary supplements to, you know, make it that much more dependent upon the manufacturer to actually prove, you know, what the product is and what is it. Make it much more like pharmaceutical drugs, frankly, is the position that they've taken. In the absence of that, as a consumer, I think you're really left on your own. Now, you know, there are some organizations out there, some public health organizations that do some independent testing of their own. Some of them share that information on websites, so you can go to some of these places and you know, they will, you could, I think it's as simple as plugging in, you know, the brand and the product, and they will tell you if they've ever tested it and what the results of those tests have been. As I say, there are now some companies that are realizing that, you know, that they have a big credibility problem here and that they are going to have to start doing things to reassure consumers that their products are indeed safe and effective and true. Some of them, you know, and they will be advertising that, you know, to their consumers. So you can be looking for that kind of labeling. But you're going to have to be a very proactive and involved consumer, I think, if you really want some assurance that you are buying what you're buying, because there's nobody out there at the moment that's actually looking out for your interests in this respect.
Jillian Findlay is a correspondent for Frontline. You can see the documentary Supplements and Safety Tuesday night, January 19th at 9 o'clock on KERA television. Jillian, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thanks. My pleasure.